Hello and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. I'm Jeremy Gordon, editor of Funds Insider at CityWire, and I'm thrilled to be joined on the podcast today by a well-known face in the city, Jupiter's John Chatfield Roberts. John is a fund manager, but rather than investing in stocks and shares directly, he heads up the 6.5 billion Jupiter Merlin range of multi-manager funds. That means he faces the same challenge on a somewhat larger scale as many other investors: how to pick the right funds to shape an effective portfolio. John, welcome. I think you enjoyed your 20th anniversary at Jupiter earlier this year. And in fact, you've been running the Merlin range even longer than that. Can you tell us a bit more about what you do?
Well, good afternoon, Jeremy. Good to be here. Thank you for the introduction. Yes, 20 years goes by in a flash. I went to Jupiter with a team of three of us, Algie Smith-Maxwell and Pete Lawrie, back in, I think it was March the 12th, to be precise, 2001. But we'd all worked at Lazard Asset Management before that. And so we were running the same funds, which in fact we then bought about 6-8 months later from Lazard. So yeah, we've been managing those Merlin funds since, I think it was March 1997 we took them over.
Okay. And your colleague Algie is still you still work together, right?
Absolutely. Algie is still very much part of the team. He's stepped back from day-to-day fund management, but he's now, we call him our director of research. And so he comes to almost all our fund management meetings. He's integral in spotting new funds. He's an interesting man to interview, Jeremy. So if he ever interviews you, he's looking inside your head. Be warned.
Interesting. Well, hopefully it'll be me interviewing him rather than the other way around. And so remind us, in terms of the range of funds, is it's five or is it six funds you run with kind of different risk bands, if that's the right way to put it?
I guess that would be a reasonable way of putting it. We started off with three, and over the years we've added a few more. But my view always was that you should limit the number of products that you run. And you're trying to not totally cover the waterfront, but say offer investment solutions for the majority of the population. And so if you look at Worldwide, on the one hand, that's a global growth fund. And if you look at Merlin Conservative, that's a fund with largely fixed interest holdings at the other end. We've got something called Merlin Real Return, which aims for a sort of steady positive return over time. But the majority of the money actually is on is mostly in equity funds, with a little bit in fixed interest.
And well, you know, given that's what you do, John, during this conversation, we're absolutely hoping to get an insight into how you pick funds. So when you're, you know, when you're looking to invest in a fund, what's the first question you tend to ask yourself?
The first question I ask myself is, when I meet the boy or girl who's running the money, am I looking at the next James Findlay? And and if you know your sort of fund history, you will know that we've held something called Findlay Park. It's now called Findlay Park American. It used to be called Findlay Park US Smaller Companies. And that was a fund which was launched in 1998 by James Findlay and Charlie Park. James Findlay and Charlie were great investors. James, well, effectively, I always felt he was the head of that team, if you like. And he was and is an outstanding investor, despite the fact that he actually is now merely a consultant to that fund. He is somebody I judge everything else by, really.
Okay. What is it about him or his approach that you like so much?
Well, he's just very good. I mean, you've got to, as an investor, you've got to have insight. You've got to be competitive. You've got to think laterally. And he's got all those three things in spades.
And so we've asked, you know, what the first question you normally ask yourself is. It now occurs to me, is there a first question you normally ask a fund manager?
No, not really. I mean, I'm afraid you treat each meeting on its merits. So you've read the backup material, and you're generally trying to get into why people behave the way they do. You're trying to get past the framing of the argument. So essentially, it's a game of either poker or bridge or chess or something like that. When you're sitting in front of a fund manager, and you're they're trying to frame an argument in the best way possible, quite obviously, as I am now. And as the potential buyer, you're trying to find out what the truth is. It's not that anybody's necessarily trying to hide the truth, but they're just trying to put the best gloss on it. What you're actually trying to work out is what they really actually do. Some people know what they do. Some people actually don't understand what they do.
Right.
So there's no general question, but it's trying to peel back the layers of the onion to find the kernel.
Yeah, and I won't ask you to name names, but I suppose when you say some people don't really know what they do, that might include some people you've met over the years who actually run quite big funds.
But I think, there's a great book written in 1948 called How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Mm.
And I think I would refer you to that as a comment.
That's fair enough, John. Now, when I started as an investment reporter, someone recommended I read a book you wrote in 2006 or published in 2006 called Fundology, The Secrets of Successful Fund Investing. Now, it was at a bit of a different stage of the passive versus active debate at the time, but a key prong of your argument really was a defense of active management, or particularly the idea that we can pick the right managers for the right prevailing economic environment. I wonder, are you still as big a believer in active management today as you were then?
The short answer is yes.
Mm.
The long answer is that I didn't quite comprehend how big the passive industry was going to get,
mm.
and therefore the effects it's had on how people invest generally and the effects on perhaps particular stocks and stock markets. So it's been a much bigger phenomenon than I anticipated.
Mm.
But I would still stick to the argument which I made, which is that not all fund managers are created equal. All we are trying to do is find that very small subset of people who can outperform and outperform on a regular basis. And you're not really actually asking for very much, in the sense of perhaps you're looking for a dozen or 20 people in a universe which is tens of thousands,
mm.
And across the globe. So, I'm not an expert on every fund manager that's ever lived, because I don't need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the thought that there aren't people out there who have that ability, which is the nub of the passive argument, it's just wrong.
Mm.
I mean, human beings are pretty clever individuals collectively, and you can find some of those people out there who really do make the grade.
Yeah.
But there just aren't many of them.
Mm-hmm. I think, one thing that has undoubtedly changed about passive investing, and where, passive investing has had a big influence on active management as well, is in charges, fees. The charges on passive products have come down and down and down. And, to invest in a FTSE 100 tracker, for example, it might be, a few basis points or 0.1% a year charge. And active funds have also come under big pressure to reduce their fees. How's that changed the picture, and how do you think about that change, I suppose?
Well, I mean, it's something I think about all the time, because,
mm.
I mean, it is capitalism, isn't it?
Mm.
So you have an industry which is seriously profitable, and then other people come in and those profits reduce,
mm-hmm.
and it's standard economic theory. So I think Amazon have a phrase along the lines of, your margin is our opportunity. Which is fascinating, because right now there's a company called Cloudflare, I think it is, in the States, which is one of the darlings. If you go and look it up, it's vertical.
Uh-huh.
But they are trying to not steal, but take a lot of Amazon's cloud-based server business, because they've worked out that Amazon's server business is really quite high margin, whereas their retail offering isn't really high margin, huge volume and lots of good things for lots of people, but where they are making a lot of money out of servers. So coming back to the fund management industry, which is actually what your question was about,
mm-hmm.
I just think of it in the same way that it's all about capitalism. So an industry perhaps was earning super normal profits at some stage in the past, and therefore those margins will come down.
Mm.
That's just the way I look at it.
And ultimately, that's a good thing for end investors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And, you're a major backer of Fundsmith Equity, which is, of course, run by Terry Smith. And, you know, they've resisted cutting, largely resisted cutting annual management fees, even as it's become a £27 billion fund or something like that. what do you think about that? Are you surprised by that? Or?
No, I'm not surprised because the other side to this, you will remember that Edward Bonham Carter is a colleague and was my boss for a long time. Mm-hmm. He, tongue-in-cheek, used to suggest that rather than having a graded fee going down as your assets rose, the graded fee should be going up because it was more difficult to run larger sums of money.
I see.
And it, so most of the questions we get asked about Fundsmith are, you know, isn't it far too big? And now it couldn't, you can't possibly manage it. So if I was Terry, I would say, well, yeah, that's absolutely right. But of course, it's a more difficult thing to do. So why should I be cutting your fees? I mean, you know, it's sophistry in some ways. Mm. But no, I mean, if you read Fundology, which I'm sure you did, rather than just propping up the leg of a wonky table, which I always thought was really what it was destined for, with a good cartoon on the front cover, mind you. Mm-hmm. I said that I thought that good investors could and did command a premium. Mm. And I would say the same for Terry.
Yeah.
But that premium probably will come down.
Okay. And, well, I suppose staying on Fundsmith, you know, Terry Smith's performance in the last year, yeah, we don't want to be too short term, but in the last year, it hasn't been quite as sparkling, but the long term record still remains very strong. And as you've said, it's a massive fund. Clearly, they're not going to be leveraging a small cap premium or anything like that. Do you think he's still on top of his game?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think Terry, I mean, whether I know Terry better than he knows me, I don't know. Uh-huh. But my observation on Terry Smith is that he's a very, very competitive individual. Mm. He absolutely concentrates on the job in hand. Mm-hmm. If you look at the performance, if you take it from before the coronavirus thing kicked off at the beginning of last year and look through the dip and back again, I think you'll find he's ahead of the world index.
Yes.
If you took it from after the coronavirus dip, you would find not. But then that's sort of not surprising because, you know, you've had some things, you know, fell 90%, so they're going to go up a lot, and he wasn't holding any of that.
Yes.
I think he stayed true to his last, if you like. Mm. And I don't have a problem with the fact that it's he's running 40 billion.
Yeah. And, I'm not saying this at all applies to Terry Smith, but a question many people face is how long to stick with a fund manager or even a whole sector of the market when it's been underperforming. How do you think about that question?
Well, I think all these things, you have to take each case on its merits. Mm. And things move slowly, but sometimes they move inexorably. If you've got a fund manager who thinks they're doing things in a certain way and you believe that actually they've moved to doing things in a different way, well, and that presumably is having an effect on their performance, that would be a very good indication of why you should be thinking about moving on.
Yeah.
But markets change as well. So, I mean, right now, you know, the American market is arguably the most expensive it's ever been. Mm. And some of the other markets in the world are not quite as cheap as they've ever been, but they're certainly a great deal cheaper.
Yeah.
But if you look at what you've had to do to generate performance over the last 5 years, actually, if you haven't been in America, you've probably got sacked by now.
Yeah.
So, you know, judgment is what you require. Mm. And there just aren't hard and fast rules.
Mm. As you were speaking about what a fund manager might think they're doing versus what you actually perceive they're doing, I couldn't help but thinking of Neil Woodford. You were quite a big investor, quite a big backer of Neil Woodford and the Woodford Equity Income Fund, I think. Yeah. Can you talk a bit, when did you first sort of realise things were going wrong?
Well, I mean, Neil Woodford's a fascinating case because we held his fund, the Investigo Fund, from 1997.
Yeah.
All the way through to when, and in big size, you know, we had north of 20% exposure to him. And we made a great deal of money out of his Investigate Perpetual funds. And then when he started up the new shop, it seemed a very sensible thing to do to switch most of the money.
Mm.
And I think we switched £680 million from memory or thereabouts, which then grew to about £1 billion. And I've looked back at my notes and, you know, thought long and hard about what we did, because we always knew he'd always in his Invesco times had some unquoteds, half a dozen thereabouts. And when he started his own fund, again, it was about half a dozen. But looking back at my notes, perhaps we weren't listening carefully enough to what he was telling us.
Right.
Because by the time we finished exiting, he'd got about 45, I think it was about 45 unquoteds. And perhaps we just didn't read the signals clearly enough. So, I mean, I could say he changed what he did, but actually I'm not necessarily sure that wasn't always the plan.
Yeah.
And we just didn't spot it, which is our fault. As it happens, we made just under 20% on our holdings by the time we got out. So we must be one of the few peoples that are, you know, hugely grateful to his, final version as opposed to just the earlier versions.
Yeah. Clearly there has been some long-term impact on the fund management industry, and you know there's this renewed focus on liquidity in open-ended funds. But I mean, do you think there's kind of lasting damage to the industry from such a big name's collapse? Or
people have awfully short memories. The answer is no, I don't think so at all.
Right.
Hargreaves Lansdowne, you know, you could have said, well, they had a problem because they got quite a lot of it.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to have affected them particularly bad. And if you go back even over my sort of investing career, you know, Morgan Grenfell European Growth, have you ever heard of that one?
I don't recall that one. No, well, what happened there?
Okay, well, that had a bit of a problem with something called British Biotechnology.
Right.
Effectively, Morgan Grenfell, who had just been taken over by Deutsche Bank, had to recompense all their investors because the fund pretty much went to zero, because the individual running it was so keen on British biotechnology, he created a whole load of shell companies, which were Luxembourg-based, I think mostly, possibly in the Caribbean as well, which all bought British biotech. So instead of having, you know, the maximum 10% exposure to one company, I think there was 40 or 50% exposure.
Right. Sounds quite terrifying.
Yeah. 1994.
I see. People do have short memories.
Correct.
Now, coming back to this point about picking the right fund managers for the right conditions, I suppose, you know, the natural question is, what kind of fund managers should we be looking for today?
Today? Well, of course, it depends what you expect the conditions to be.
Mm.
Because it's not necessarily about what the conditions are right now.
Mm.
It's what you expect the conditions to be in the next 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, whatever your time period is. I mean, the things we can see around us are the fact that we're all using more kit technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, hastened perhaps by the coronavirus pandemic, but it's, you know, everybody, you know, as you came into this room, there was I reading an email. Appalling behaviour. I apologise for it, but you know, we all do it, and so there are things like that you as an investor you need to make money out of.
Mm.
Lots of people are making money out of that sort of thing. And at the other end of the spectrum, you look at the UK market and you think, well, gosh, we've had the Brexit referendum, we then had Brexit, we've got COVID, etc. And the UK market's now only 4% of the world index, whereas certainly when I started, it was over, I think it was 10 or 12%. So arguably, the UK stock market is seriously undervalued.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking about that, you need a value UK fund.
Mm.
If you're thinking about what I said earlier, you need technology. And then, of course, perhaps you have to say to yourself, well, actually, I'm not really quite sure. So you need a bit of each.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that point, I think looking at the fact sheet for the Merlin Growth Fund, so you've actually got more than 25% of the portfolio in UK equities.
So little.
so little. So I suppose that means you think it's not just undervalued, but very undervalued. There's still a kind of screaming opportunity in the UK.
Well, I mean, again, this almost sounds like a history lesson, but but back in the 1990s, that portfolio would have had 65% in UK equities.
Right.
So when I say so little, it's slightly tongue-in-cheek. But we got below 20% in the run-up to the vaccine announcement a year ago. And at that point, we probably added around about 50% exposure, i.e. from whatever it was, 18 or thereabouts, up to about 30 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have moved it about. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing is, we are a small island off the coast of Europe. We have some huge advantages in terms of connectivity, both east and west. We've got seriously good universities. We've got a lot of IP potential. But there are bits of sand in the well-oiled machine. And if you look at our stock market compared to, say, the US, the percentage of technology is very, very small. And so, you know, there are some good things and there are some not so good things. And you have to weigh it up.
Yeah. And so do you, you know, when you say that back in the, I think the 90s, you said you used to have 60% in UK equities. Yeah. You know, I think you're... The phenomenon of home bias is well known, and that's something that has been unwinding for UK investors, as in UK investors have been tending to invest more in global stocks or global funds in recent years. Do you think there's still a case for home bias?
I think you've got to think quite carefully about currency. Currency is the one area where I've seen people trip up in really, you know, major proportions. Particularly as a UK investor, over the years, it's been the right thing to do to buy overseas holdings because, generally speaking, they're priced in dollars or euros. And over the years, sterling has gently depreciated. And so as an investor, you've done well just by that.
Yeah.
Fixed interest investors, bizarrely, I think it's bizarre, have, certainly in the funds world, have to hedge all their overseas exposure back into sterling.
Yeah.
And so... I don't think they do so well by that. But home bias, remember the pension funds. So Gordon Brown, again back in the 90s, changed the taxation rules for pension funds, reducing the attractiveness of dividends to them. And then changed the rules about how much fixed interest a fund needed to have to be solvent. And so there's been a constant unwinding of UK equity positions from the pension fund industry, which I think has been overlooked.
Right. And they've been forced to buy bonds broadly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and mostly it's been coming out of UK equities because that's where most pension funds had their money.
Yeah.
So I think you would have thought it had done most of its unwinding by now. So and the UK market really is quite cheap.
Okay. Interesting. The next question I wanted to ask is, it looks like quite a difficult time to be a fixed income investor. I would say with interest rates set to rise, we don't know if the new Omicron variant will have an effect on that or not. How do you navigate that environment?
Well, I think I must put my heart on my sleeve. I believe in equities. I don't really believe in fixed interest. Part of the reason for that is growing up in the 1970s when inflation really was quite a problem. You know, inflation of over 20% a year. Suddenly, you know, your wage packet is diminishing in purchasing power pretty quickly. And if you owned equities, that sort of kept up, obviously with much, much bigger volatility, particularly 1974, I think, when the all share fell 80%. But fixed interest investors just got taken out and shot, really, because their purchasing power just was destroyed. So I'm not a great believer in fixed interest. I buy it because I have to, or I say we, the team, have to in the funds that are required to own fixed interest.
Yeah.
But in a rising rate environment with inflation around, Yeah, I mean, if you can hang on to your money in fixed interest, I think you're probably doing well.
Okay, people do well to heed the lessons of the 1970s, though.
Well, but the trouble is, I mean, the flip side of that is everybody is moulded by how they were brought up. Mm. So if you invested on the basis of the 1970s for the last 20 years, you got it wrong completely, because we just had a declining inflation up until about a year ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think Roman emperors had somebody tapping their shoulder saying, "Sire, you're only human." An investor needs to constantly revisit their own prejudices, because every day is a new day. You didn't have to have the portfolio you started with yesterday. And yeah, no, I mean, I never stop learning.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've just got to keep learning.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, what one thing that has there's been growing discussion in kind of asset allocation circles, we might say, about Bitcoin. Perhaps Brexit used to be the dreaded B word, and now maybe it's Bitcoin, depending on your view. You know, do you think there's any case for people investing in Bitcoin or buying Bitcoin, you know, yeah, speculating on it?
Perhaps I've been wrong, but I'm pretty cynical about it.
Mm.
We do own some gold in the portfolios, which we've varied over the time. We use it as an insurance policy.
Yeah.
And people say that Bitcoin is the new gold, and it's based on the same premise that this supply of gold is limited and the supply of Bitcoin is limited. I can't recall how many coins there are out there now, but there are, I think it's well over 1,000, and Bitcoin itself has had a few forks over the time. So I'm not utterly convinced that the supply of all these things is totally unlimited. I sort of feel it's more speculation.
Yeah.
And I feel it's related to the amount of money being printed by central banks generally,
okay,
which is creating pretty unusual monetary conditions, but conditions that are enabling speculations to go well.
Yeah.
So I'm cynical on Bitcoin.
So you won't be rushing to invest in it soon?
No, but I have to say, I mean, Pete Laurie, who I mentioned earlier, who's was an original member of the team, he would be on the other side of the fence.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. He reckons he's looked into it pretty deeply.
Mm.
He reckons there's 15% that you sort of can't, though, but the 85% that you could know if you bothered to do the work, which he has, he's happy with.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, I mean, you know, it's who has a monopoly on wisdom?
Okay. And another hot trend I wanted to ask about is thematic investing. You know, there's been an explosion of interest in areas like clean energy, which, you know, should have many years of structural growth ahead of them. You know, what do you make about that thematic approach?
And there's nothing wrong with thematic investing at all. And I think you noted that we own something called Blue Box Global,
yes,
Technology, which we can come back to if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So over the years, I've owned financials funds, technology funds, natural resources funds. So thematic investing definitely has its place. I'm always a little bit concerned about when areas are very hot, because hot areas tend to attract not all the right people. Undoubtedly, there's going to be a huge amount of investment in infrastructure, and some of it is going to be directed investment. You know, I think governments will be trying to persuade investors with tax breaks and that sort of thing to invest in areas. Sometimes when investment is sort of encouraged, it doesn't necessarily always turn out to be financially good for the investor.
Right.
It might be good for creating whatever the infrastructure you want is, but it doesn't always work out. I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but the Channel Tunnel, you might be aware that this was originally financed by a private consortium, and there were shareholders. And as an individual shareholder, I think over a certain limit, you got a lifetime's free travel on the tunnel.
Right.
But unfortunately, of course, the original investors got taken out because did it fall into liquidation? I mean, certainly the original investors lost all their money.
Yeah.
We've got a jolly nice tunnel, which does a whole heap of things which we wouldn't be able to do if we didn't have it.
Mm.
but those original investors just have sore heads.
Okay. Beware the hot ticket. Yeah, you mentioned the Blue Box Global Technology Fund. Let's talk about that a bit. I mean, you know, how do you go about selecting a technology fund first? Okay.
Well, it is definitely an area that you want to keep your feet on the ground.
Mm.
What we've got here is a guy called William DeGale, who used to run technology money for BlackRock.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he'll mind me saying if I say that he wears a pair of braces. He, for Americans, they're called suspenders, but in this country, we won't call them braces.
Which conjures a slightly old school image.
Indeed. He's an accountant by training.
Mm.
And if you met him, I don't think you'd mind me saying that he's not a technology nerd.
Mm.
What he wants to do is buy companies that are making genuine profits and therefore have longevity. He's not trying to buy the next blue sky thing. You know, so he'll miss out on currently something like Cloudflare, which is going gangbusters in share price terms.
Yeah.
But it's something where you've got your feet on the ground. You've got known financial metrics that you can compare things to.
Mm.
So, you know, something like Microsoft, which is, I think, the biggest holding currently, would be a classic example. But he's got a lot of semiconductor manufacturers because there is a shortage.
Mm.
And that shortage, he thinks, is going to last for quite a while. And so what we liked about it was the fact that it was keeping its feet on the ground. It was a small fund, so we like buying small funds. We think there are more opportunities to be got from that sort of thing.
Mm.
And you know, if you want to buy a technology fund, and obviously, you know, my compliance person would say that I am not recommending this for private investors. Buy a Merlin fund instead. But you have to make up your own mind. And I've met a lot of technology investors over the years.
Mm.
And we like William.
Okay, interesting. Let's discuss the performance of the Merlin range a bit. You know, you say you're really a believer in equities. Most of the funds have beaten the performance of their multi-asset sector peers in recent years. But the funds that do invest most heavily in equities, I think that's the growth and worldwide portfolios, have struggled to keep up with the average global fund. Have you been disappointed by that?
Well, the disappointing one in relative terms is worldwide,
because
that should have kept up with a global fund.
Mm.
No, I'm not disappointed with growth at all, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm actually really rather chipper about it. I think you can put it back down to one word, and that is America.
Right.
Because as we discussed earlier, the staggering outperformance of the American stock market over the last 5 years, for instance, or longer, certainly, it has to be seen to be believed. And so if what you're trying to do is run a diversified portfolio and you've got your global fund, which would have had to have had probably 70 or 80% in America, that arguably might not be what you should be doing. Perhaps arguably you should be doing that, I don't know. But as soon as you had any Far East or UK, slightly to a lesser extent Europe, you reduce the outcome. I'm actually pretty chipper about all our performance, but again, you know, the compliance people say I'm not allowed to advertise things.
Yeah.
But no, the one disappointment in relative terms is worldwide, despite the fact it actually is the best performing fund that we've got.
Yes. how do you think about that kind of America question now? Because as you say, America, you know, the American stock market has kept going up and up, and part of that is multiple expansion, but part of it is also some fantastic performance of the biggest companies like Microsoft.
Yeah,
How are you thinking about America at the moment?
Well, I think you have to get your head around the fact that you've got a backdrop of QE and very, very low interest rates, coupled with huge companies that we almost have to use as individuals or company or, you know, corporations on a daily basis, say your Apple phone or your Google search or YouTube or Excel or Word or whatever it is. So I think you have to get your head around that, the fact that these are seriously profitable companies that you probably have to pay up to own. Nothing goes on forever, so things will change. I don't know what those changes will be, but at the moment, I'm okay with it. But I am aware that, as you said, multiple expansion has definitely been out there, and continues to be out there. And if you look at the American stock markets, the earnings, where those the earnings increase growth has come over the last 5 or 10 years. 90% has come from the technology sector.
Right.
So I think you sort of almost have to divide those two things and in your own head make an allowance for that.
Okay. Last question from me, if that's all right, John. I was sort of slightly rude asking this, and we did reference it slightly before we started, but you know, we mentioned you've been at Jupiter. You've enjoyed your 20th anniversary at Jupiter this year, and I think you actually had a short career doing something else before for fund management. Do you have any plans to step back in terms of your day to day duties at all, or are you still kind of all guns blazing?
Jeremy, as I said before, when we were chatting earlier, if I was asking you the question, you would have said Gary Potter's just retired, Bamos Ham is just
retired.
That's
right.
You grew up with them, and why are you still here? Well, I'm 59. Nobody goes on forever. I've got no plans to retire at the moment. I love what I do.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, John. I think that's an excellent note to end on. So thanks very much for coming in today, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thank you. And last thing to say is thank you to everyone at home for listening to the podcast, and please look out for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts soon.